For the reading this morning, I chose to begin reading from the beginning of Arhata Magga, Arhata Pala, which is a book, a compilation of Ajahn Mahabhua's Dhamma talks, centering around his personal path of practice. And so this starts right from the beginning, and I won't try to reach any particular point because they're all different talks. That's why it starts kind of abruptly. I'll just start from the beginning and get to a good stopping point. And this talk is called The Direct Route to the End of All Suffering. At present, all that is left of Buddhism are the words of the Buddha. Only his teachings, the scriptures, remain. Please be aware of this. Due to the corruption caused by the defiling nature of the kalesas, true spiritual principles are no longer practiced in present-day Buddhism. As Buddhists, we constantly allow our minds to be agitated and confused, engulfed in mental defilements that assail us from every direction. They so overpower our minds that we never rise above these contaminating influences, no matter how hard we try. The vast majority of people are not even interested enough to try. They simply close their eyes and allow the onslaught to overwhelm them. They don't even attempt to put up the least amount of resistance. Since they lack the mindfulness needed to pay attention to the consequences of their thoughts, all their thinking and all they do and say are instances of the kalesas giving them a beating. They surrendered to the power of these ruinous forces such a long time ago that they now lack any motivation to restrain their wayward thoughts. When mindfulness is absent, the kalesas work with impunity, day and night, in every sphere of activity. In the process, they increasingly burden and oppress the hearts and minds of people everywhere with dukkha. In the time of the Buddha, his direct disciples were true practitioners of the way of Buddhism. They renounced the world for the express purpose of transcending dukkha. Regardless of their social status, age, or gender, when they ordained under the Buddha's guidance, they changed their habitual ways of thinking, acting, and speaking to the way of the Dhamma. Casting the kalesas aside, the disciples ceased to follow their lead. From that moment on, with earnest effort, they directed all their energy towards purifying their hearts and cleansing them of the contamination created by the kalesas. In essence, earnest effort is synonymous with the meditator's endeavor to maintain steady and continuous mindful awareness, always striving to keep a constant watch on the mind. When mindfulness oversees all our mental and emotional activities, at all times and all postures, this is called right effort. Whether we're engaged in formal meditation practice or not, if we earnestly endeavor to keep our minds firmly focused in the present moment, we constantly offset the threat posed by the kalesas. The kalesas work tirelessly to churn out thoughts of the past and future. This distracts the mind, drawing it away from the present moment and from the mindful awareness that maintains our effort. For this reason, meditators should not allow their minds to wander into worldly thoughts about the past or future. Such thinking is invariably bound up with the kalesas and thus hinders practice. Instead of following the tendency of the kalesas to focus externally on the affairs of the world outside, meditators must focus internally and become aware of the mind's inner world. This is essential. Largely because they are not sufficiently resolute in applying basic principles in meditation, many meditators fail to gain satisfactory results. I always teach my pupils to be very precise in their pursuit and to have a clear and specific focus in their meditation. That way they are sure to get good results. It is important to find a suitable object of attention to properly prepare the mind for this kind of work. I usually recommend a preparatory meditation word, whose continuous mental repetition acts as an anchor that quickly grounds the meditator's mind in a state of meditative calm and concentration. If a meditator simply focuses attention on the presence of awareness in the mind, without a meditation word to anchor him, the results are bound to be hit and miss. The mind's knowing presence is too subtle to give mindfulness a firm basis, so the mind soon strays into thinking and distraction, lured by the siren call of the kalesas. Meditation practice then becomes patchy. At certain times, it seems to progress smoothly, almost effortlessly, only to become suddenly and unexpectedly difficult. It falters, and all apparent progress disappears. With its confidence shaken, the mind is left floundering. However, if we use a meditation word as an anchor to solidly ground our mindfulness, then the mind is sure to attain a state of meditative calm and concentration in the shortest possible time. It will also have the means to maintain that calm state with ease. I am speaking here from personal experience. When I first began to meditate, my practice lacked a solid foundation. Since I had yet to discover the right method to look after my mind, my practice was in a constant state of flux. It could make steady progress for a while, only to decline rapidly and fall back to its original, untutored condition. Due to the intense effort I exerted in the beginning, my mind succeeded in attaining a calm and concentrated state of samadhi. It felt as substantial and stable as a mountain. Still, lacking a suitable method for maintaining this state, I took it easy and rested on my laurels. That was when my practice suffered a decline. My practice began to deteriorate, but I didn't know how to reverse the decline. So I thought long and hard, trying to find a firm basis on which I could expect to stabilize my mind. Eventually, I came to the conclusion that mindfulness had deserted me because my fundamentals were wrong. I lacked a meditation word to act as a precise focus for my attention. I was forced to begin my practice anew. This time I first drove a stake firmly into the ground and held tightly to it, no matter what happened. That stake was Buddha, the recollection of the Buddha. I made the meditation word Buddha the sole object of my attention. I focused on the mental repetition of Buddha to the exclusion of everything else. Buddha became my sole objective, even as I made sure that mindfulness was always in control to direct the effort. All thoughts of progress or decline were put aside. I would let happen whatever was going to happen. I was determined not to indulge in my old thought patterns, thinking about the past, when my practice was progressing nicely, and of how it collapsed, then thinking of the future, hoping that somehow, through a strong desire to succeed, my previous sense of contentment would return on its own. All the while, I had failed to create the condition that would bring about the desired results. I merely wished to see improvement, only to be disappointed when it failed to materialize. For, in truth, desire for success does not bring success. Only mindful effort will. This time I resolved that, no matter what occurred, I should just let it happen. Fretting about progress and decline was a source of agitation, distracting me from the present moment and from the work at hand. Only the mindful repetition of Buddha could prevent fluctuations in my meditation. It was paramount that I center the mind on awareness of the immediate present. Discursive thinking could not be allowed to disrupt concentration. To practice meditation earnestly to attain an end to all suffering, you must be totally committed to the work at each successive stage of the path. Nothing less than total commitment will succeed. To experience the deepest levels of samadhi and achieve the most profound levels of wisdom, you cannot afford to be half-hearted and listless, forever wavering because you lack firm principles to guide your practice. Meditators without a firm commitment to the principles of practice can meditate their entire lives without gaining the proper results. In the initial stages of practice, you must find a stable object of meditation with which to anchor your mind. Don't just focus casually on an ambiguous object, like awareness that is always present as the mind's intrinsic nature. Without a specific object of attention to hold your mind, it will be almost impossible to keep your attention from wandering. This is a recipe for failure. In the end, you'll become disappointed and give up trying. When mindfulness loses its focus, the kalesas rush in to drag your thoughts to a past long gone or to a future yet to come. The mind becomes unstable and strays aimlessly over the mental landscape, never remaining still or contented for a moment. This is how meditators lose ground while watching their meditation practice collapse. The only antidote is a single, uncomplicated focal point of attention, such as a meditation word or the breath. Choose one that seems most appropriate to you, and focus steadfastly on that one object to the exclusion of everything else. Total commitment is essential to the task. If you choose the breath as your focal point, make yourself fully aware of each in-breath and out-breath. Notice the sensation created by the breath's movement, and fix your attention on the point where that feeling is most prominent, where the sensation of the breath is felt most acutely, for example, the tip of the nose. Make sure you know when the breath comes in and when it goes out, but don't follow its course. Simply focus on the spot where it passes through. If you find it helpful, combine your breathing with a silent repetition of Budo, thinking Bud on the inhalation and Do on the point of exhalation. Don't allow errant thoughts to interfere with the work you are doing. This is an exercise in awareness of the present moment, so remain alert and fully attentive. As mindfulness gradually establishes itself, the mind will stop paying attention to harmful thoughts and emotions. It will lose interest in its usual preoccupations. Undistracted, it will settle further and further into calm and stillness. At the same time, the breath, which is coarse when you first begin focusing on it, gradually becomes more and more refined. It may even reach the stage where it completely disappears from your conscious awareness. It becomes so subtle and refined that it fades and disappears. There is no breath at that time. Only the mind's essential knowing nature remains. My choice was Budo meditation. From the moment I made my resolve, I kept my mind from straying from the repetition of Budo. From the moment I awoke in the morning until I slept at night, I forced myself to think only of Budo. At the same time, I ceased to be preoccupied with thoughts of progress and decline. If my meditation made progress, it would do so with Budo. If it declined, it would go down with Budo. In either case, Budo was my sole preoccupation. All other concerns were irrelevant. Maintaining such single-minded concentration is not an easy task. I had to literally force my mind to remain entwined with Budo, each and every moment without interruption. Regardless of whether I was seated in meditation, walking meditation, or simply doing my daily chores, the word Budo resonated deeply within my mind at all times. By nature and temperament, I was always extremely resolute and uncompromising. This tendency worked to my advantage. In the end, I became so earnestly committed to the task that nothing could shake my resolve. No errant thought could separate my mind from Budo. Working at this practice day after day, I always made certain that Budo resonated in close harmony with my present moment awareness. Soon I began to see the results of calm and concentration arise clearly within the citta, the mind's essential knowing nature. At that stage, I began to see the very subtle and refined nature of the citta. The longer I internalized Budo, the more subtle the citta became, until eventually the subtlety of Budo and the subtlety of the citta melded into one another and became one in the same essence of knowing. I could not separate Budo from the citta's subtle nature. Try as I might, I could not make the word Budo appear in my mind. Through diligence and perseverance, Budo had become so closely unified with the citta that Budo no longer itself appeared within my awareness. The mind had become so calm and still, so profoundly subtle, that nothing, not even Budo, resonated there. This meditative stage is analogous to the disappearance of the breath, as mentioned above. When this took place, I felt bewildered. I had predicated my whole practice on holding steadfastly to Budo. Now that Budo was no longer apparent, where would I focus my attention? Up to this point, Budo had been my mainstay. Now it had disappeared. No matter how hard I tried to recover this focus, it was lost. I was in a quandary. All that remained then was the citta's profoundly subtle knowing nature, a pure and simple awareness, bright and clear. There was nothing concrete within that awareness to latch onto. I realized then that nothing invades the mind's sphere of awareness when consciousness, its knowing presence, reaches such a profound and subtle condition. I was left with only one choice. With the loss of Budo, I had to focus my attention on the essential sense of awareness and knowing that was all present and prominent at that moment. That consciousness had not disappeared. On the contrary, it was all pervasive. All of the mindful awareness that had concentrated on the repetition of Budo was then firmly refocused on the very subtle knowing presence of the calm and converged citta, My attention remained firmly fixed on that subtle knowing essence until eventually its prominence began to fade, allowing my normal awareness to become reestablished. As normal awareness returned, Buddha manifested itself once more. So I immediately refocused my attention on the repetition of my meditation word. Before long, my daily practice assumed a new rhythm. I concentrated intently on Buddha until consciousness resolved into that clear, brilliant state of the mind's essential knowing nature. Remaining absorbed in that subtle knowing presence until normal awareness returned, and then I refocused with increased vigor on the repetition of Buddha. It was during this stage that I first gained a solid spiritual foundation in my meditation practice. From then on, my practice progressed steadily. Never again did it fall into decline. With each passing day, my mind became increasingly calm, peaceful, and concentrated. The fluctuations that had long plagued me ceased to be an issue. Concerns about the state of my practice were replaced by mindfulness, rooted in the present moment. The intensity of this mindful presence was incompatible with thoughts of the past or future. My center of activity was the present moment, each silent repetition of Buddha as it arose and passed away. I had no interest in anything else. In the end, I was convinced that the reason for my mind's previous state of flux was the lack of mindfulness arising from not anchoring my attention with the meditation word. Instead, I had just focused on a general feeling of inner awareness without a specific object, allowing my mind to stray easily as thoughts intruded. Once I understood the correct method for this initial stage of meditation, I applied myself to the task with such earnest commitment that I refused to allow mindfulness to lapse for even a single moment. Beginning in the morning when I awoke, and continuing until night when I fell asleep, I was consciously aware of my meditation at each and every moment of my waking hours. It was a difficult ordeal, requiring the utmost concentration and perseverance. I couldn't afford to let down my guard and relax even for a moment. Being so intently concentrated on the internalization of Buddha, I hardly noticed what went on around me. My normal daily interactions passed by in a blur, but Buddha was always sharply in focus. My commitment to the meditation word was total. With this firm foundation to bolster my practice, mental calm and concentration became so unshakable that they felt as solid and unyielding as a mountain. Eventually, this rock-solid condition of the mind became the primary point of focus for mindfulness. As the citta steadily gained greater inner stability, resulting in a higher degree of integration, the meditation word Buddha gradually faded from awareness, leaving the calm and concentrated state of the mind's essential knowing nature to be perceived prominently on its own. By that stage, the mind had advanced to samadhi, an intense state of focused awareness, assuming a life of its own independent of any meditation technique. Fully calm and unified, the knowing presence itself became the sole focus of attention, a condition of mind so prominent and powerful that nothing else can arise to dislodge it. This is known as the mind being in a state of continuous samadhi. In other words, the citta is samadhi. Both are one and the same. Speaking in terms of the deeper levels of meditation practice, a fundamental difference exists between a state of meditative calm and a samadhi state. When the mind converges and drops into a calm, concentrated state to remain for a period of time before withdrawing to normal consciousness, this is known as meditative calm. The calm and concentration are temporary conditions that last while the mind remains fixed in that peaceful state. As normal consciousness returns, these extraordinary conditions gradually dissipate. However, as the meditator becomes more adept at this practice, entering into and withdrawing from a calm, unified state over and over again, the mind begins to build a solid inner foundation. When this foundation becomes unshakable in all circumstances, the mind is known to be in a state of continuous samadhi. Then, even when the mind withdraws from meditative calm, it still feels solid and compact, as though nothing can disturb its inward focus. The citta, that is continuously unified in samadhi, is always even and unperturbed. It feels completely satiated. Because of the very compact and concentrated sense of inner unity, everyday thoughts and emotions no longer make an impact. In such a state, the mind has no desire to think about anything. completely peaceful and contented within itself, nothing is felt to be lacking. In such a state of continuous calm and concentration, the citta becomes very powerful. While the mind was previously hungry to experience thoughts and emotions, it now shuns them as a nuisance. Before, it was so agitated that it couldn't stop thinking and imagining even if it wanted to. Now, with samadhi as its habitual condition, the mind feels no desire to think about anything. It views thought as an unwanted disturbance. When the mind's essential knowing presence stands out prominently all the time, the citta is so inwardly concentrated that it tolerates no disturbance. Because of this sublime tranquility and the tendency of samadhi to lull the mind into this state of serene satisfaction, those whose minds have attained continuous samadhi tend to become strongly attached to it. It remains so until one reaches the level of practice where wisdom prevails, and the results become even more satisfying. From then on, I accelerated my efforts. It was at that time that I began sitting in meditation all night long, from dusk until dawn. While sitting one night, I started focusing inward as usual. Because it had already developed a good, strong foundation, the mind easily entered into samadhi. So long as the citta rested there calmly, it remained unaware of external bodily feelings. But when I withdrew from samadhi many hours later, I began to experience them in full. Eventually, my body was so racked by severe pain that I could hardly cope. The citta was suddenly unnerved, and a strong foundation completely collapsed. The entire body was filled with excruciating pain, such that it quivered all over. Thus began the bout of hand-to-hand combat that gave me insight into an important meditation technique. Until the unexpected appearance that night of such severe pain, I had not thought of trying to sit all night. I had never made such a resolution. I was simply practicing seated meditation as I normally did, but when the pain began to overwhelm me, I thought, "Hey, what's going on here? I must make every effort to figure out this pain tonight." So I made the solemn resolve that no matter what happened, I would not get up from my seat until dawn of the next day. I was determined to investigate the nature of pain until I understood it clearly and distinctly. I would have to dig deep, but if need be, I was willing to die in order to find out the truth about pain. Wisdom began to tackle this problem in earnest. Before I found myself cornered like that with no way out, I never imagined that wisdom could be so sharp and incisive. It went to work, relentlessly whirling around as it probed into the source of the pain with the determination of a warrior who never retreats or accepts defeat. This experience convinced me that in moments of real crisis, wisdom arises to meet the challenge. We are not fated to be ignorant forever. When truly backed into a corner, we are bound to be able to find a way to help ourselves. It happened to me that night. When I was cornered and overwhelmed by severe pain, mindfulness and wisdom just dug in to the painful feelings. The pain began as hot flashes along the back of my hands and feet, but that was really quite mild. When it arose in full force, the entire body was ablaze in pain. All the bones and joints connecting them were like fuel feeding the fire that engulfed the body. It felt as though every bone in my body was breaking apart, as though my neck would snap and my head drop to the floor. When all parts of the body hurt at once, the pain is so intense that one doesn't know how to begin stemming the tide long enough just to breathe. This crisis left mindfulness and wisdom with no alternative but to dig down into the pain, searching for the exact spot where it felt most severe. Mindfulness and wisdom probed and investigated right where the pain was greatest, trying to isolate it so as to see it clearly. Where does this pain originate? Who suffers the pain? They asked these questions of each bodily part and found that each one of them remained in keeping with its own internal nature. The skin was skin, the flesh was flesh, the tendons were tendons, and so forth. They had been so from the day of birth. Pain, on the other hand, is something that comes and goes, periodically. It's not always there in the same way that flesh and skin are. Ordinarily, the pain and the body appear to be bound up together. But are they really? Focusing inward, I could see that each part of the body was a physical reality. What is real stays that way. As I searched the mass of bodily pain, I saw that one point was more severe than all the others. If pain and body are one, and all parts of the body are equally real, then why was the pain stronger in one part than in another? So I tried to separate out and isolate each aspect. At that point in the investigation, mindfulness and wisdom were indispensable. They had to sweep through the areas that hurt and then whirl around the most intense ones, always working to separate the feeling from the body. Having observed the body, they quickly shifted their attention to the pain, then to the citta. These three, body, pain, and citta, are the main principles in this investigation. Although the bodily pain was obviously very strong, I could see that the citta was calm and unafflicted. No matter how much discomfort the body suffered, the citta was not distressed or agitated. This intrigued me. Normally the kleshas join forces with pain, and this alliance causes the citta to be disturbed by the body's suffering. This prompted wisdom to probe into the nature of the body, the nature of pain, and the nature of the citta, until all three were perceived clearly as separate realities, each true in its own natural sphere. I saw clearly that it was the citta that defined feeling as being painful and unpleasant. Otherwise, pain was merely a natural phenomenon that occurred. It was not an integral part of the body, nor was it intrinsic to the citta. As soon as this principle became absolutely clear, the pain vanished in an instant. At that moment, the body was simply the body, a separate reality on its own. Pain was simply feeling, and in a flash, that feeling vanished straight from the citta. As soon as the pain vanished from the citta knew that the pain had disappeared. It just vanished without a trace. In addition, the entire physical body vanished from awareness. At that moment, I was not consciously aware of the body at all. Only a simple and harmonious awareness remained, alone on its own. That's all. The citta was so exceedingly refined as to be indescribable. It simply knew. A profound, subtle, inner state of awareness pervaded. The body had completely disappeared. Although my physical form still sat in meditation, I was completely unconscious of it. The pain, too, had disappeared. No physical feelings were left at all. Only the citta's essential knowing nature remained. All thinking had stopped. The mind was not forming a single thought. When thinking ceases, not the slightest movement disturbs the inner stillness. Unwavering, the citta remains firmly fixed in its solitude. Due to the power of mindfulness and wisdom, the hot, searing pain that had afflicted my body had vanished completely. Even my body had disappeared from consciousness. The knowing presence existed alone, as though suspended in midair. It was totally empty, but at the same time vibrantly aware. Because the physical elements did not interact with it, the citta had no sense that the body existed. This knowing presence was a pure and solitary awareness that was not connected to anything whatsoever. It was awesome, majestic, and truly magnificent. It was an incredibly amazing experience. The pain was completely gone, the body had disappeared, and awareness, so fine and subtle that I cannot describe it, was the only thing not to disappear. It simply appeared, that's all I can say. It was a truly amazing inner state of being. There was no movement, not even the slightest rippling inside the citta. It remained fully absorbed in stillness until enough time had elapsed, and then it stirred and began to withdraw from samadhi. It rippled briefly and then went quiet again. This rippling happens naturally of its own accord. It cannot be intended. Any intention brings the citta right back to normal consciousness. When the citta thus absorbed in stillness has had enough, it begins to stir. It is aware that a ripple stirs briefly and then ceases. Some moments later, it ripples briefly again, disappearing in the same instant. Gradually, the rippling becomes more and more frequent, and when the citta has converged to the very base of samadhi, it does not withdraw all at once. This was very evident to me. The citta rippled only slightly, meaning that a sankhara formed briefly, only to disappear before it could become intelligible. Having rippled, it just vanished. Again and again it rippled and vanished, gradually increasing in frequency, until my citta eventually returned to ordinary consciousness. I then became aware of my physical presence, but the pain was still gone. Initially I felt no pain at all, and only slowly did it begin to reappear. This experience reinforced the solid spiritual foundation in my heart with an unshakable certainty. I had realized the basic principle in contending with pain. Pain, body, and citta are all distinctly separate phenomena. But because of a single mental defilement, delusion, they all converge into one. Delusion pervades the citta like an insidious poison, contaminating our perceptions and distorting the truth. Pain is simply a natural phenomenon that occurs on its own. But when we grab a hold of it as a burning discomfort, it immediately becomes hot because our defining it makes it that way. After a while, the pain returned, so I had to tackle it again without retreating. I probed deep into the painful feelings, investigating them as I had done before. But this time I could not use the same investigative techniques that I had previously used to such good effect. Techniques employed in the past were no longer relevant to the present moment. In order to keep pace with internal events as they unfolded, I needed fresh tactics, newly devised by mindfulness and wisdom and tailor-made for present circumstances. The nature of the pain was still the same, but the tactics had to be suitable to the immediate conditions. Even though I had used them successfully once before, I could not remedy the new situation by holding on to old investigative techniques. Fresh, innovative techniques were required, ones devised in the heat of battle to deal with present moment conditions. Mindfulness and wisdom went to work anew, and before long the citta once again converged to the very base of samadhi. During the course of that night, the citta converged like this 3 times, but I had to engage in bouts of hand-to-hand combat each time. After the 3rd time, dawn came, bringing to a close that decisive showdown. The citta emerged bold, exultant, and utterly fearless. Fear of death had ceased that night.
Well, I heard about Lompo Chai took Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Mahamon to go and visit like Lompa Mahabua and maybe Ajahn Khao and maybe some others, but I just heard that the trip existed. I didn't hear anything. Do you know about with the interaction between Lompo Cha or Lompo Sumedho and any of those teachers or any teachings that went on during that trip?
The one that stood out for Ajahn Sumedho was the meeting with Bukhao and where they had sat and talked and very kind of friendly, very friendly, warm, back and forth between Lompo Cha and Lompo Khao. Ajahn Mahamon, of course, they're going back and forth in the Isan language, and Ajahn Sumedho has no idea what's going on. He's just kind of patiently enduring. And then after they spent however long together, Ajahn Chah took leave. Leaving, then Lumpu Khao, because Ajahn Sumedho was the last person out leaving, letting the senior monks go first, and Lumpu Khao just sort of made a very animated kind of getting Ajahn Sumedho's attention, and probably knowing that he didn't understand anything that went on, he's just pointing. It's all here. It's all here. that was really keeping it simple. Also, the other thing that was memorable from that meeting with Lumpu Khao was that it was shortly before traveling to go up there, then Ajahn Chah was given a tape recorder, And he, when they met Mupukal, then they set it out. He set it out to record the meeting with the, and then when they got back, then that went back to listen to it, and there was nothing there except for one point where Mupukal farted. That's the only thing that was recorded. Ajahn Chah loved it. It was great. That's the only thing that sort of took on the recording.
Different tools for dealing with pain the second time that he encountered it. I just wondered if you had any advice for working with pain.
Well, I think one of the things is just that I think how Lukana Habu expresses it in the sense of being willing to look at it in different ways and approach it rather than having I've got this set method, and this is how it's going to work, and this is how it's going to pan out, and you know that kind of plan is fraught with inherent difficulty. So that willingness to investigate and experiment, okay, what's going to work, what's not going to work, what's how to either bring in, things that you have to be willing to approach it and investigate it and experiment and see what actually is going to work, rather than okay, I've got this game plan and this is what's going to do it, because that's just a perception and an idea and an idealized version of what one's practice is going to be. So that willingness to be present with the experience, and then to be open to intuiting what's going to be beneficial, what's going to be interesting, what's going to be suitable for that occasion. Sometimes it's sort of going in and picking it apart. Sometimes it's loving kindness. Sometimes it's any number of things. But there, you have to be willing to experiment. I mean, that's the sort of key to it.